Series in Nehemiah, and we have a packed one this morning. We're going to read all of chapter 3, which reads like a Hebrew phone book. So you're going to enjoy listening to me do that. But before we do that, let me pray. Most gracious Father, we thank you again that we can gather, that we can sing, we can connect with each other, we can pray, we can come and listen to your word being preached. Lord, we ask that your spirit would open our hearts and minds. We've all had different weeks, some great, some okay, some not so good weeks, Lord. And so we just pray right now that you would steady us, that our hearts and minds would be open to what you want us to hear, that we'd be open to listening, but not just listening and then applying and doing, you'd be working in our lives. We ask this and pray this in Jesus' name, and everyone said amen. So we're going to jump straight into it, remembering that we are in chapter 3, and Nehemiah was called by God to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the Babylonians invaded, exiled the Hebrew people. Now the new superpower of the day are the Persians. King Artaxerxes is the king, supreme ruler, you could say, and Nehemiah was the cupbearer. Nehemiah prays to God that he would have an opportunity to go back and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. A city without a wall is a city that is not protected. Not only that, a city out of war says to everyone else, your God doesn't love you, your God is weak, your God is insignificant, he doesn't even give you a war for your city. And this eats away at Nehemiah, so much so that he leaves the comfort of being a cupbearer to come and rebuild the walls. Now, we know he's arrived, he's looked around, he's surveyed all the options, what the problems are, and he's told the people, this is what they're going to do, let's do this together. And they respond. They respond by saying, yep, we're going to do it. And now we see that they're going to get their hands dirty and they actually start to rebuild the walls. And we've been looking at this concept of building up, building in, and building out. As we read this story, you know, the very walls that Nehemiah built are still there today. You can go to Jerusalem and you'll see those walls, which is incredible, really, when you think about that. But this concept of building up, as in us individually as Christians, we want to build up, we want to reflect Jesus, we want to walk in the ways of Jesus, our behaviors, our actions, the way we speak should be more like Jesus each day. And so we build up. And then build in, meaning us as a congregation, us as a local body of believers, we should be spurring each other on, building in to each other, encouraging each other in their walk of faith, coming along practically and helping, and then also building out. It doesn't stop at up and in. The most important part really is to go out. That as we build up, as we build into each other, our desire to go out, to reach others with the message of Jesus should grow stronger, and we should want to do that stepping out in faith. And so we're looking at this in the book of Nehemiah. So let's have a read. Chapter 3, I normally get people up to come and read this, because it's really hard. For someone who English was his fifth language, let's get into it. Nehemiah chapter 3, Elshabib the high priest and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building it as far as the Tower of Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Hanel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zakur, the son of Imri, built next to them. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hashanah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Mirmoth, son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, if you don't know it, you just sound confident, you just keep moving, repaired the next section. Next to him was Mashalam, son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, son of Bana, made repairs. And next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa. But their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. The Janiah gate was repaired by Jodiah, son of Pasiah, and Meshalem, son of Besadiah. They laid its beams and put down its doors and bolts and bars in place. Next to them, repairs were made by the men of Gibeon and Mesbah, and Malatiah and Gibeon and Jadon and Meronoth, places under the authority of governor of Trans-Euphrates. Uzel. How would you say that one? Uzil, son of Harahiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section of Hananiah, One of the perfume makers made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the Broad Wall. Rephaiah, son of Hur, ruler of half-district Jerusalem, repaired the next section. Adjoining this, Jediah, son of Harumaph. Caleb, you should be reading this. There is a point to this. Harumaph, son of Moab, repaired another section in the Tower of Ovens. Shalem, son of Halashesh. Oh, did I skip a bit? Where are we up to? Just making sure you're following. Son of Hur, ruler of half-district, Jerusalem repaired the next section, adjoining opposite his house. And Hatush, we got that bit? Son of Hashbaniah made repairs next to them. Keep going, Caleb. That sounds so good, doesn't it? He does it really good. Repaired another section of the Tower of Ovens. Shalem, son of Halahesh. You don't have to every time, but I gave you a chance. But half district of Jerusalem repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. The Valley Gate, keep going, was repaired by Hanum and the residents of Zenoa. They rebuilt it and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. They also repaired 500 yards of the wall as far as the Dung Gate. The Dung Gate was repaired to, my Bible's actually ripped there. What is that one? There we go. A son of Rechab, ruler in the district of Beth, Hiram. He rebuilt it. Gee, there's a long way to go. He rebuilt it and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. The Fountain Gate was repaired by Shelah, son of, yes, ruler of the district, Mizpah. This is nice. He rebuilt it, roofing it over and putting its doors and bolts and bars in place. He also repaired the wall of Pool of Siloam by the king's garden, as far as the steps going down from the city of David. You can go to all these places, by the way. Beyond him, Nehemiah, I know that one, son of Azbuk, ruler of the half-district of Beth-Zur, made repairs up to the point opposite the tombs of David. There we go, that's a good name. As far as the artificial pool and the house of the heroes. Next to him, the repairs were made by the Levites under Rehum, son of Bani. Beside him, Hashabiah, ruler of the half-district of Kilo, that's good, carried out repairs for his district. Next to him, the repairs were made by their countrymen under Benui, son of Henadad, ruler of the other half district of... Good. Next to him, this is like English. What's that English first learning? Yeah, whatever. It's not really English, is it? Where are we up to? Verse 19. Azur, son of Jeshiah, ruler of Mizpah, repaired another section from a point facing the accent of to the Armony as far as the angle. Okay, I'm there. Next to him, Bara, son of Zebediah. You guys are voting on a new senior pastor today. Zealously repaired another section from the... I've already read that. Verse 21, next to him, Mirmoth, son of Uriah, son of Hakoz, repaired another section from the entrance to that guy's house to the end of it. The repairs next to him were made by the priests from the surrounding region. Beyond them, Benjamin and Hashab made repairs in front of their house, and next to them, Azariah, son of Maaseiah, the son of Ananiah, made repairs beside his house. Next to him, Binui, son of Henadad, repaired another section from Azariah's house to the angle and the corner. And Pelal, son of Uzziah, worked opposite the angle and the tower projecting from the upper place near the court of the guard. Next to him, Peadiah, son of Perosh, and the temple servants living in the hill of Ophel made repairs up to the point opposite the water gate toward the east and the projecting tower. Next to them, the men of Tekoa. The men of Tekoa, remember the others? The nobles wouldn't work. Repaired another section from the great projecting tower to the wall of Ophel opposite the house. Next to him, oh, here we go, we're on the home stretch. Shemaiah, son of... Shechaniah, the guard of the east gate made repairs. Next to him, Hananiah, son of Shelemiah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zelophah, repaired another section. Next to them, Meshullam, son of Berechiah, made repairs opposite living quarters. Next to him, Melchijah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs as far as the house of the temple servants and the merchants opposite the inspection gate and as far as the room above the corner and between the room above the corner and the sheep gate, and the goldsmith and the merchants made repairs. There we go. Don't clap. Do not clap. Far out. That was harder than I remember it. That's why I normally get people to read it. But now, what is the point of that? That is a lot of names, a lot of gates, a lot of this, a lot of bolts, a lot of doing all that kind of stuff. The reason why I did want to read it is because, one, it's in the story. A lot of commentators actually skip chapter 3. Chapter 3 is kind of almost looking back at the work already being completed. Chuck Swindoll, I think I mentioned this in the little pre-blurb, in his commentary, he's done a great commentary on Nehemiah. He, again, just skips chapter 3. It reads, like I said, a Hebrew phone book. What's the point of it? But actually, there's some really good stuff in there, and I think it says something. If Nehemiah goes to the point of mentioning people's names of people who have done the work, who stood up in that time of need, time of crisis, the time that this needed to get done, he says it's important that he writes it down. Interestingly, you only see Nehemiah's name, I think, once. Doesn't mention himself. Everyone else. He was there obviously working, but he mentions everyone else. So let's have a look at three main things we can get out of this massive chapter of names and tasks. The first point is this, the purpose of the work. We've been asking the question, what is the purpose of the work? Chapter 2, verse 17, we see the purpose of the work. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. Remember, this is why they were rebuilding the walls, not just to fortify the city, but it was about honoring God. Hey, let's rebuild the walls so we won't be in disgrace, so we won't reflect poorly on God. There was this bigger mission, this bigger vision. It wasn't just about laying bricks and mortar and getting the job done. No, it was so that we would no longer be in disgrace. The purpose of the work had a bigger vision. The purpose of the work had a real mission behind it. And so often, even in the church, we can fall into this ho-hum kind of attitude, and we can actually forget, the purpose of the work is so much bigger than the pastor reading chapter 3. The purpose of the work is so much bigger than even coming to sing. The purpose of the work isn't just about us coming and drinking coffee. No, the purpose, we got the greatest mission in the world. Jesus leaves and says, go and make disciples. Go out, build out. Reach people, tell people, live amongst people, demonstrate my love amongst them, reflect my love amongst them, show them, tell them. And so this is the mission, this is the vision. This isn't boring. This should get us up out of bed. We should be like this. We will no longer be in disgrace. That should motivate us. And so the purpose of the work isn't just laying bricks. It's something much bigger than that. Vision is very important. Mission is very important. Can anyone tell me who this person here is? It's a new, don't say Elon Musk in a Tesla. Anyone know? Henry Ford. So Henry Ford, obviously you know, made cars, the Ford car. But what was so interesting, his vision, or his mission in creating cars, it wasn't just to make a car, but his vision was that every American family would be able to afford a car. An automobile. And that's why he created the production line, to make it cheaper, to make it quicker, therefore American families could afford. So it wasn't just putting bits together, it wasn't just making a car, it was something greater than that, and that was that every American family would be able to afford an automobile. And so there's that vision. What about this guy here? We probably know him. Anyone know him? Billy Graham had the best hair, especially in younger years. His hair was so nice. But his vision, I don't know if you know the story there, him and a group of college mates, they wanted, again, to preach the gospel, but they had this vision of preaching to thousands of people. They said, why don't we can pack out stadiums for sporting events. Wouldn't it be great if we packed out stadiums to come and hear the gospel? to come and hear the message of Jesus Christ, him and a group of friends. Now, you know the story of Billy Graham. They reckon it's estimated that he preached to over 1 billion people. 1 billion, that's life. That's incredible, the amount of people that Billy Graham has preached to. But there's a greater, it's not just, you know, let's just do a talk. No, there's something bigger than that. And that's what I want us to understand, that actually the things that we do, there's something bigger than that underneath it. We don't just gather to come and connect and talk and that. No, it's a greater mission. We don't just run toddler jam just for because we've got some leaders who like to do music and dance in front of kids. No, it's greater than that. There's the youth group. We don't just do that because we don't have anything to do on a Friday night. No, the mission under that is far, far more important. We want to see families. We want to see individuals affected, transformed by the life of Jesus Christ. That's why we're here, yes? And so we need to remind ourselves and live that out. Because as soon as we forget that, we start to get or go through the motions. We start to get apathy. You think of the people of Jerusalem. Remember, they were there when Nehemiah found out what the walls were like. 50 years earlier, a group of about 50,000 went back to try to rebuild. 100 years since Jerusalem was invaded. And so the 50,000 people who were living there, they were apathetic. They were comfortable with their situation. They thought, oh, it's okay. And apathy had kind of creeped in. Look at this great quote here up on the screen in regards to Christian and being careful with apathy. Go to the next slide there, Brian. Apathy can only be overcome by enthusiasm, and enthusiasm can only be aroused by two things. First, an ideal which takes the imagination by storm, and second, a definite and tangible plan by carrying out the idea into practice. So Nehemiah comes along and he creates this enthusiastic, hey guys, remember we talked about this? It smells here, you smell. You know, you're sitting in this, it's not good. You bring disgrace to yourselves and to God. And he motivates, says enthusiastic, we're going to build the walls. Not because we need, you know, it's not just about the walls, it's something greater. And the danger for us as a church is that we end up just doing church. I don't know who said this, but it's a great quote, and it's got to do with, it might have been Christine Kane that said something like, the church has become, we've become carers of the aquarium instead of fishers of men. And that we just worry about ourselves and everything's really comfortable instead of building out. And that's where this missional drift comes along. You look at some of the universities in America. Harvard University, founded in 1636, was a Christian university. Some of these great learning institutions were Christian universities, and now they're the most secular places in the world. You think of the YMCA. Do you know what the YMCA was? Yep, and it started as a Bible study. A Bible study for displaced men in the UK. And that was Christian at its core. It's not Christian at its core now. They forgot what their mission was. They started just building bricks and putting down, making a wall instead of, no, there was something greater. And we need to be careful as a church that we don't become like that. Missional drift, it's called. Here's a quote here by Peter Green, a church missions guy. He says, without careful attention, faith-based organizations will inevitably drift from their founding mission. And so we always keep coming back. That's why we have to, I think, have a natural tendency or a bigger focus on reaching out. Because it's almost human nature to focus on self. Yes? The Bible, when we look through the scriptures, we'll see that the church, there's many functions of the church. There's probably, you could probably put down 5 key things that we're meant to do. We're meant to worship. We're meant to, so coming as a worshiping body, learning as in the scriptures, practical needs and helping and looking after each other. A mission. Mission is one. And there's another one. Yeah, prayer, probably there. And so we can do the other 4. Because they're very self-focused. I want to hear this type of music. I can read my Bible. I want to care for my brothers and sisters. We need to do that. But we can forget the mission. And that's why we need to almost have a greater focus on mission, on outreach. Otherwise, we will lose balance and start to look inwards. So we're always focusing out, because that's our mission, to make disciples. You think of Peter, when Jesus said he was going to go to the cross and die. That was Jesus' mission, wasn't it? And what did Peter say? Don't do that. Don't do that, Jesus. People love it when you walk on water and, you know, you heal people and your teaching is great. But don't talk about death. That's silly. And what did Jesus say to him? Get behind me, Satan. Jesus accuses Peter, who's one of his main guys, as working for the opposition. Peter started to missionally drift. Jesus said, this is the mission. I'm going to the cross. Peter says, no one likes that stuff, that talk. The other stuff's great. Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. So we don't want to lose our mission, the purpose of the work. Remind ourselves of the purpose. So no matter what task you're doing here at the church, whether you're in the kitchen, whether you're up here worship, whether you're a youth group leader, whether you're in Sunday school, whether you're at Toddler Jam or the Village, or whether you're doing a parky care run, picking up stuff from Coles, you think you're not just doing that. Remind yourself of the greater mission of what you're doing. You're doing it because you want to see people come to know Jesus. You're doing it because you want to see people come to grow in their understanding experience of Jesus. Yes? That's why you're doing it. You're not just doing a mundane task. You're doing it so people would come to know Jesus. So the purpose of the work. If you look at marathon runners, you never see, unless they break a leg, you don't see people pull out of the marathon in the first K, do you? Or the last K. The first K, they've just started. So obviously they're pretty fresh. If they don't get through the first K, they probably haven't done enough training. And it's in the middle there. You can't see the end. You can't see where you can't, you know, you've already started and it's kind of like, oh, actually, McDonald's looks good. Or you just stop. Whereas at the end, the last K, you can see the finish line. You know, that's why the Bible to Jesus and the scriptures talk about focusing and focusing and focusing. Key point one, the purpose of the work. Our purpose, we've got the greatest mission in the world. Go and make disciples. Tell people about Jesus. Live like Jesus. Be an example to people about Jesus. Can we do that? Sometimes it's hard because sometimes our own interests, our own things that we want to do can pull against that. Well, that's going to make it uncomfortable for me. If I have to give up a chair for someone I don't know or whatever it is, remind ourselves of the mission. Second thing we see from this passage, and this is really clear, that's why I tortured myself to read it all out, was the people of the work. So we see the purpose of the work is greater than just the war. Then we see the people of the work. Everyone is involved, aren't they? I know, because I just read all their names out. Everyone is involved. And that's why chapter 3 goes to great lengths to say these were the people that were involved. Their names, but also what else does it list? Their occupations, what they did. This guy was a priest, this guy was a temple servant, this guy was a perfumist. Maybe it wasn't, was the guy the perfumist? Okay. This person was a merchant, this person was a builder. So all different occupations, probably different status, class status, doesn't matter. Everyone comes together and does the work. And hopefully you would have, maybe you didn't notice the phrase. There was one phrase there that comes up, I don't know, 30 plus times almost, next to him was this, they're working together. Next to him was this person, next to him was, it's this, everyone is together. Look at this quote here, I find this is an interesting quote up here on the screen. Although God could bring about whatever he wants simply by willing it into existence, most of the time God seems to achieve his ends through the cooperation of people. When we read through scriptures, we see that, don't we? That God uses people coming together to cooperate, to work together as a team. He could do whatever he wanted to. He could just do that or bring in some new people, but he doesn't. He says, you guys get along. This is what I want you to do. Figure it out and get the job done. And when that happens, it's great. It's beautiful. Now, there's friction. There's problems. There's issues. And some people don't like these people. And not everyone wants to help. And we even see that in that story, don't we? There was a few that didn't help. But that's the way God chooses to work. And I reckon one of the reasons he does that is not even because of the work. I reckon it's also got to do with what he wants to do in us as we work next to him and next to him. Because when we work next to him, him can be a pain in the backside, and then it tests my patience and I get annoyed and, well, hang on, I'm shaping you in the process, yes? And so it's the actual, even the act of coming together and working as a team, you have to learn to be more like Jesus. And testing and growing and showing encouragement and loving and praying and all those types of things. We see this. We see this community. We don't see uniformity though, do we? They're all different. And that's okay. They're focused on one aspect, the mission, no longer be in disgrace, to bring glory to God. We're all different, doing different things, and we're working together next to him. 23 times that phrase is mentioned. And so we see that, everyone involved, and also we see a teamwork, incredible teamwork. We see this great teamwork coming together as they do this. Here's a few definitions on team. Two of my favorite ones, cooperative or coordinated effort on the part of a group of persons acting together as a team on the interests of a common cause. A common cause greater than ourselves. Teamwork means that we share a common ideal, embrace a common goal. Regardless of our differences, we strive shoulder to shoulder, confident in one another's faith, trust, and commitment. In the end, teamwork can be summed up in 5 short words: we believe in each other. And so teamwork is incredibly important for us as a church. And teamwork sounds a little bit non-Bible and non-spiritual, but that's what it is. We come together and we cooperate. We've got a goal greater than ourselves to reflect Jesus, to show Jesus. And we come, how do we do that together? And we see that team there. Here's some great teams. I think I've shown you a few of these photos before. This is one of the best teams ever. That was taken yesterday after they lost to North Melbourne. Another team here, the hockey girls, hockey team, I think it is. Incredible. Their record, incredible hockey team. I think, was Rick Charlesworth the coach? Yes, did a great job with those ladies. Next one here, anyone know that team? Apollo, is it an Apollo? 11? There they are, beautiful, Buzz Lightyear. Next one, that's one of my favourite teams. Did anyone grow up watching that? Hand up, if you, yes, the A team. B.A. Baracus, look at that. I don't know how he doesn't, he probably sees a chiropractor now because carrying all that gold around his neck would be hard. Next one here, this was the very first heart surgery open. I don't know how many people on that team. You have to cooperate. You have to get along. Otherwise, the mission is what? That this person gets a new heart. You can't be selfish. You can't, you know, you got to work as a team. Everyone different skills, everyone gifts. It's great. Next photo here. Anyone know what that photo's from? The Thailand caves. I don't know if you ever saw the documentary on that. Mate, I got claustrophobic just watching it. It's incredible what these guys did. And then the next one here, I think, do I have another one? No, that's it. Okay, I was going to put a picture up of you guys, but we'll take one later. Romans 12, we know this passage well up here on the screen. Romans 12 talks about, again, how the church is a body. Next slide there, Brian. Oh, we got a Mother Teresa quote, sorry. You can do what I cannot do. I can do what you cannot do. Together we can do great things. It's a true quote as well. We've all got different gifts. We've all got different abilities. Romans, Apostle Paul puts it like this. And because of God's gracious gift to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you should. Instead, be modest in your thinking and judge yourself according to the amount of faith that God has given you. We have many parts in the one body, and all these parts have different functions. In the same way, though, we are many, we are one body in union with Christ. We're all joined to each other as different parts of one body. There we go. So we are to use our different gifts in accordance with the grace that God has given us. If our gift is to speak God's message, we should do it according to the faith that we have. If it is to serve, we serve. If it is to teach, we teach. If it is to encourage others, we should do so. Whoever shares with others should do it generously. Whoever has authority should work hard. Whoever shows kindness to others should do it cheerfully. Again, just to say that we're a team. God chooses to work through us, people who cooperate together to do his mission. So we have the purpose of the work, we have the people of the work, and then the last point here, we have the pattern of the work. And again, why I read it out was so we could see the pattern. It was team orientated, it was a team effort, but two things that I noticed. One, as he delegated authority, so he delegates authority to certain groups of people. And he says, you guys work on that part of the wall. And actually, if you, when we read it, it goes through, I think it was clockwise. And when you do a bit of study on it, you'll find that the people actually live quite close to the part that they're working on as well. But delegated authority. As in, hey, you look after this. I give you this task. You can do it. You've got the Holy Spirit in you. I see gifts in you. You lead it. You run it. There's delegated authority. And the other thing that we see is it's done in manageable sections. Manageable sections. How do you eat an elephant? I've never eaten an elephant, but apparently it's one bite at a time in manageable sections. And sometimes the task can be too big. We talked about the walls of Jerusalem being around about nearly 5 km around, some points 12 meters high, 2 meters wide. That's a big job, yes? But let's break it down. This will give delegated authority. You're in charge of this group, manageable sections, and they all kind of join up. Now, it might look pretty simple, but this is great practical advice that even as a church, we want to delegate authority for certain areas and people leading teams and manageable sections. You can't have one person doing everything, can you? And you don't want to have no one doing nothing. So we have manageable sections. How do we, you know, you think of Billy Graham. Now, obviously, the Spirit of God was moving, but to have this massive vision, and then to have thousands. What did he have when he preached at the Melbourne Cricket Ground? 100,000 people. Imagine the logistics. 145,000 people. Billy Graham, you have to organize the stage. Billy Graham, you have to do the welcoming. Billy Graham, you have to do the follow-up. Did he have to do all of that? Billy Graham, his gift was what? To preach the gospel. But there was hundreds, thousands of other people working, had authority to do certain things, follow up and manageable sections. We've all got different parts. We all play different roles. I remember when I was at Bible college and like I said, I struggled through school and English was my fifth language. I'm not sure what my first one was, but when we got an assignment, you know, you have an assignment, 3,000 words or whatever, 5,000, I'd be like, man, so painful, you know, and you just start writing stuff like, went and took the dog to the book, and I'm like, that's got nothing to do with my, but then someone told me, again, not rocket science, 200 word lots, Anthony, work on 200 words, and if you get a good reference, you know, quote someone, that'll get some word count up. But 200 word lots. And so once I even had on my sticky notes, I would have like a 200 word. Once I'd done 200 word, I would have 2 days off. But the 200 word chunks made sense to me because I could, that's more manageable instead of focusing on the 5,000. And then I actually found that I end up putting too much words in my assignments, a bit like my sermons. They go longer than they should. But manageable sections, manageable sections, chunks, youth ministry, children's ministry, toddler jam, the village, what else we got? Parky pantry, the community care shops, Sunday school, worship team, all these different things. Not one person should be doing them all. Should be spread out, lots of people using their gifts in that one area. And so we have the purpose of the work, we have the people of the work, we have the pattern of the work. And the thing I want to say this is they worked. They worked. Except one bunch. It was the nobles of Tekoa. They didn't work. It said that they didn't put their shoulders to do the work. Now, the servants or the non-nobles from Tekoa, they worked. In fact, they got two jobs. So it looks like they finished their section and went on and helped out in another section. But the point is this, they worked. Now, there is a season, where you can come and have a season where you're meant to rest, absolutely. And there are seasons where you're meant to be cared for, absolutely. But overall, as a church, we come and we work. We use our gifts. We share. We do all that stuff. We don't want to be like the nobles of Tekoa. We don't want to have they didn't work. They didn't put their arms to the shoulder. No, we come. Are there times when you rest? Absolutely. Are there times when you're just cared for? Absolutely. 100%. But overall, we're all working and doing things in different ways using our gifts. The Bible talks about us not being lazy. The Bible talks about us working hard, not for our salvation, but just generally to work hard, to look after people, all that kind of stuff. My dad taught me at the age of 4 that if you don't work, you don't eat. I don't know if it was the age of 4, but he ought to say, if you don't work, you don't eat. If you want to eat, you work. And that's why I didn't go into fruit and veggie, because it's hard work. It's hard work doing fruit and veg. But there's simple principle, yeah? If you want to eat, you work. You want to eat, you work. And there's a sense, maybe as a society, we've lost a little bit of that, that we want other people to do all the work for us. And it's, what can I get? What can I get? You know, apparently volunteers are on the decline. You look at a lot of sporting clubs and community organisations, they struggle to get volunteers because we've lost a bit of that. How can I help? How can I serve? How can I work? And the church, again, we please don't hear that I'm saying that, you know, we get a big whip out. But as a church, we want to be serving each other. We want to be caring for each other, not one person doing it. We all want to be doing it. The church comes together. So we got the purpose, the mission. We got the people, that is us. We got the pattern, everyone using their gifts, everyone doing different things in teams, manageable sections. And then we get in there and we do it. We cheer each other on. We encourage each other. We cry with each other. We laugh with each other. We work together. We do it together. You may have seen this. I showed this image before at our volunteers' Christmas last year. But I think it's important that we look at this next image here. On the top there, you have a hotel room, probably cheap hotel room maybe. And then on the bottom, you have a house, someone's house. When you go to a hotel room, when I go to a hotel, I use everything. Even if I'm not going to use it, I turn on all the lights, I turn on all the taps, I take toilet paper, the soaps, I take the shampoo, even though I don't have shampoo. I'm like, Siobhan's like, you can't take the painting off the wall. No, we paid for it. And so I just like, I'm taking what I can get. I don't care if the floor's messy. It's not my house, it's a hotel. I paid for it. But my house? No. I look after my house. You've got to keep it quiet. Turn off the lights. Don't turn the water on, kids. I can only have a cold shower. But it's my house. I take care of it. I mow the lawn, wash the floors, the windows. Why? Because it's my house, and I take care. It's not that actually isn't my house, by the way. I've got tomatoes and a few other things. Broad beans. Actually, my dad came around last week and planted some broad beans. I'll bring him to church for you in a couple of weeks. So what is the difference? Some of us treat the church like a hotel room where we come and we just take everything. Like me, you know, coming out of the run, I've got the pillow. When actually it's a home, it's our house. It's family house, and you own it, to use that word. You own it. It's your church. And so if it's your church, well, what do you want it to look like? How do you want it to feel? You know, what do you want people to feel when they come? What do you want people to see when they come? So if you see something out there, you think, oh, that's not, oh, let's fix that, because it's like your house. So it's not like a hotel room. It's like a home. The other analogy, as we wrap all this up, the two difference between the cruise, I've never been on a cruise, and my wife, Siobhan, really wants to go on a cruise. And you eat, and you, what else do you do? Eat. Has anyone been on a cruise? I'm going to do a survey right now. Hands up if you loved it. Oh, okay. Still not convinced. But you go there to be served. You go there to have fun. You go there to be entertained, don't you? Whereas the one at the bottom, I'm not keen on that one either, that's a battleship. Yes? Aircraft carrier, sorry. But they're there for war, aren't they? They're there to fight a battle. The people who are there aren't waiting for drinks and, you know, what time's karaoke? They're not doing that on the battleship. They're there to serve and work and help and to work as a what? As a team. And the church is more like a battleship. Not that we're going to war. We got a spiritual battle, but we're not going to war with people. But we're more like a battleship than a cruise ship. We come together, we work, we have a mission, we have a task, and every single one of us can play a role. You might not think you can play a role. You can play a massive role, even just by the way you speak to others, the way you encourage, what Sue said today. You bring joy to others. The purpose of the work, the people of the work, the pattern of the work. We want to be a church that builds up in and out. Yes? Let's do that. Let's pray. Most gracious.